Welcome to the Middle of the Air.
Hi, this is Ken Butcher with the Middle of the Air. In Charlotte, North Carolina, a group of four authors realized they all had books coming out this summer. They decided to team up for their launch party and their promotional tour. They're calling their alliance Authors Out of Carolina. Three of these visited us at the Novels and Novelty Bookstore here in Hendersonville, and I got a chance to talk to them before their panel discussion. If you get a little confused about who's talking about what book, don't worry. We list all the websites near the end of the interview and also in the show notes on the website for the Middle of the Air. Now let's join Joy Calloway, Erica Marks, and Kim Wright. Hey, this is Ken Butcher, and we are in Novels and Novelty Bookstore, and I have a special podcast today because I have three authors visiting all at once, and you three are doing a panel discussion in about an hour or so called Truth in Fiction, right?
Correct. Yes.
So talk a little. Well, first of all, I want you to introduce yourselves.
Okay.
And say the book that you're here promoting, and then we'll get down to some other questions.
Okay, I'm Joy Calloway, and my book is The Fifth Avenue Artist Society.
And I'm Kim Wright, and I'm the author of Last Ride to Graceland.
And I'm Erica Marks, and I'm the author of The Last Treasure.
Excellent. Well, thank you, ladies, for agreeing to do this. So I want to hear something about the books. I know they're all women's literature with some degree of historical element in them. So how about if we start with that? Joy?
Okay. Well, my book is actually based on my family history. It's based on my grandmother's great-grandma and her siblings. They were all artists, and they lived in the Bronx during the Gilded Age. And I always thought their story was really compelling because they were artists at a time when it wasn't very common for women to do so, nor was it very easy. And so their story always struck me. And so when I was over at my grandmother's house during Christmas one year, I was kind of sitting there surrounded by these women's portraits and just thought, you know, why haven't I thought to write down their story before? And from there, I kind of tried to imagine what their lives would have been like, even though we know snippets, of course,
right,
but we don't know everything. So a lot of the fiction in my book is kind of me imagining what their lives were possibly like. We knew that they knew a lot of famous artists there. One of the portraits is done by Robert Hamilton, who was a painter at the time. And mm-hmm. then Hamilton Revell, who was kind of a scandalous actor at the time, also painted a picture of one, of their home.
Right.
And then they were very close friends with Bernard Wall, who was an etcher.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, I started thinking, well, they knew these. They were not famous in their own right, really. But they somehow came across all these interesting people, and how would they have done that? So that's kind of how the Fifth Avenue Artist Society itself came to mind. And so, yeah.
Okay. I had a question when I did have a chance to read part of that, and I was wondering what drew you to that time period, but I guess it's the specific people that you based it on.
Right. It's just the historical setting of when they lived. And we actually were fortunate after I finished with the book, we actually found the diaries of the main character.
No
Virginia.
Way.
Yeah. On a rare book site, and we thought, who got rid of these, you know? But we bought them back. And so it was interesting to see kind of that actually, you know, her tone and the manner in which she lived was actually very similar to my imagining, which, who knows? I think
did you find anything in those diaries that said, that made you say, wow, I wish I'd have known that?
To be honest, most of the things that I found out, I'd written in there without really, you know, knowing. But, for instance, in the book, this is going to come as no shock. When you first open the book, you find that Virginia, the main character, who's the writer, is a writer. She kind of thinks she's going to end up with her next-door neighbor, who is also he's a painter,
right.
A sketcher. And she experiences heartbreak. And we realized in Virginia's diaries that she actually experienced something very similar in real life with a doctor she was going to see. And
mm-hmm.
It was strange to see that we didn't know. All we knew is that out of these women, only one of them went on to get married and the rest didn't.
Mm-hmm.
They just pursued their art. And so I liked to imagine that Virginia had the option. And so that's why I created that, you know, possibility in the book. But it was cool to see that she actually in real life did have kind of a
right.
romantic interest
right.
in that it went down kind of the way I imagined. So
what about, your book is The Lost Treasure, is that right?
Nope, that's me.
I'm sorry, I'm getting you mixed up already.
It's okay.
Go ahead and talk about
it. Oh, okay.
Eric.
Yes, my book is The Last Treasure.
The Last Treasure.
We also have Last Ride to Graceland. So we
promise
we did not mean to make it so confusing. We should have checked with each other first. We will plan better for the next one.
That's okay.
I promise. My book is set on the Carolina coast. It's contemporary. The main plot is a contemporary story of three treasure hunters who are reunited. They were two men and a woman who were very, very good friends, often lovers at one point, not all together, but one of the men and one of the women, one of the men and the woman, and they had many years together as treasure hunters, and then it all fell apart when their love stories broke apart. And they are all reunited in the present story to find do one final mission, and it brings them all together, brings all of this sort of buried romantic tension back to the surface. In the backstory is the story of the Patriot, which was the ship, the schooner carrying Theodosia Burr, who's Aaron Burr's daughter, beloved daughter. And it disappeared off the coast of Carolina in 1813, and no one knows to this day whatever happened to it.
And that's an actual historical.
Exactly. It was an actual historical. It's a real story that I was able to pull the characters out of to fit into this novel, because the heroine in the present story, Liv, is very, very consumed with the story of Theodosia and what happened to her, because they both share, and this is just a little bit of a tease, they both share very complicated relationships with their fathers.
Okay.
So that was really the focus of bringing that historical aspect into it. And what's really neat is when I first started the story and I found out about the Patriot and Theodosia, the Hamilton, the musical, had not taken off and had not exploded onto the scene in this amazing way that it has. So it's been a really neat experience to have been writing the story and find out about these characters who I think were incredibly compelling. And then the rest of the world through this amazing musical has been able to do the same. So there's been a lot of really neat timing aspects to the story as well.
And how did you come across, or when did you come across that little snippet of history about that shipwreck?
Well, I knew that I wanted to have a shipwreck as the focus of the story, of the backstory. I thought initially I would make one up, and I did a lot of research on the many ships that have sunk off of the Carolina coast. The Graveyard of the Atlantic is the area that they refer to. And I had no intention of using an actual historic wreck, and then I came upon the Patriot. And like I said, I found through the learning about Theodosia Burr and her complicated relationship with her father that so mirrored the relationship with my main character and her father, I thought, okay, this is all too perfect. And when those parallels comes together like that, it's too exciting. So that was really the reason that I selected it.
Excellent. And Kim? Now, The Last Ride to Graceland.
Very good.
All right. I got it right. If I eliminate the other two, it helps me figure out who's...
Too. This is, we're not making this easy
right
on you.
Yeah.
That's right.
We're going to change things.
Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, I actually got the idea. I was, we're all from Charlotte, and I was lying in the bed one day flipping through the Charlotte Observer, and that was actually the title of an article, Last Ride to Graceland. And it was about that they had finally dug out the car that Elvis Presley drove on the last day of his life. He went to the dentist very early in the morning in this big black muscle car, Stutz Blackhawk, and they just bubble wrapped it after he died. And they decided, for some reason, they're expanding the garage at Graceland, to cut open the bubble wrap, and they put it on a truck and carried it back to Charlotte to have it kind of restored at the NASCAR Museum. So that's why it was in the Charlotte Observer. The actual car was coming back to Charlotte. And it kind of got me going, because there was this one line in the article, which I think writers kind of live for these types of lines, where it was like, they said it was like opening a time capsule. That when they opened the car, that they found a napkin with drops of blood where he had been at the dentist and apparently dabbed his mouth. He could still smell his cologne. There was a styrofoam cup with the imprint of a woman's cherry red lipstick. And so it kind of got my imagination going, what happened in that car on the last day that he died. And before I'd gotten out of bed that morning, I had kind of like outlined the entire book and imagined that the car was found not at Graceland, but that a struggling blues singer named Corey found it in her family fishing shed. in Beaufort, South Carolina, and that her mother had been a backup singer for Elvis Presley.
Okay.
And her mother, named Honey, recently deceased. And she finds it and thinks, like, how did this car, Mom obviously drove it from Graceland, how did it end up here? Why did they hide it from me all these years? And decides, by following the trail of trash in the car, to replicate the journey her mother must have taken 37 years earlier,
okay,
right after Elvis died.
Okay.
So kind of like these ladies, when you do this, you know, Corey's a fictitious character. She wants to know the truth about her parentage. She was born 7 months after her parents got married, so there's plenty of questions. And Honey, her mother, is a fictional character, but Elvis obviously isn't.
Right.
So I did some basic research on Elvis Presley, what it would have been like to live at Graceland, what it would have been like to have toured with him.
Did you go to Graceland?
Yes, I went to Graceland. It was pretty funny, actually, because I was pretty deep in the research when I actually went to Graceland. I did the whole trip myself. I replicated the trip in the book myself, which was quite a thing, because in the book, she's driving a muscle car with a coon hound, and I was in a Prius with a terrier. So I like to say, this was a New South.
Almost the same thing.
Well, I took a New South trip. She took an Old South trip. So, but it was still quite the adventure, Prius or no. And when I got to Graceland, they've got the car from the year before, which is apparently just about like that, sitting up on this big thing behind velvet ropes and everything. So I'm dying to look at the car, you know. I mean, 90% of the book takes place in this car. So I'm standing at it from every angle looking in. It's just like you'd imagine, gaudy and wonderful. It's got these red velvet things and 24-karat gold fixtures and all that stuff. The security guard sees me, you know, kind of jockeying to look inside this car, and he says, would you like to go up to it? So they drop the velvet ropes. I told him I was a writer, which is, when in doubt, use that sentence, I am a writer, which gets you strange privilege.
It'll either get you thrown out or get you into
that and a bag of chips.
People are really glad to hear it or really, really not. But he took me up there and actually let me get really close to the car, and so it was a very cool experience.
Cool. Now, I'm really interested in genres. One of the fun things that's, when I started doing this podcast, it's gotten me, you know, I've interviewed romance novelists now, and now you three are women's fiction. That seems like it covers a lot of ground.
It's an ocean.
It's like at least half the people on Earth.
Right, so, yeah.
tell me what your definition of women's fiction is, and maybe if there's a subgenre you consider your books in.
Well, I think women's fiction is just really about the female journey in life, and it can encompass a lot of things, which is the point of why we all, you know, all of our books are very similar, but we're all kind of in a different subgenre, I think you should say. And I think mine is historical because it's dealing with the, but I think it's still pertinent today, which is really great. I think that history, we can learn a lot from it, but that people are people generally, and that we can learn a lot from what our ancestors did, and we can learn a lot from what our contemporaries now are doing. So I think there's a lot of beauty in that, but definitely the Fifth Avenue Art Society is historical women's fiction.
Now, this is your first novel, is that right?
That's right.
And do you think you're going to stay with historical women's fiction? Are you going to stay in that subgenre or genre?
Absolutely. I think I was just telling Erica actually downstairs that I went down a wormhole the other day. I found a street name that was in a small town near Charlotte, and it was a woman's name that I had unearthed in a random dissertation that I was doing some research for a new book about her, and that she lived since she was two in this one mill house and in a small town outside of Charlotte. And I thought, and then a street name is named after her. And I thought, well, that's just compelling. Who is she? You know? So I went down this wormhole for like 4 hours trying to find this woman and who she was. And I couldn't find anything. And so I think that interest is just something that will never go away. I think history is just so interesting to me, the way people have lived, and just the way people react in different types of situations. And I think, you know, in present day, we have similar, you know, we have technology, we have different things like that. It's so interesting to see and imagine what it would have been like without some of the things we kind of take for granted today. So
you're going to stick with history, not necessarily that time period of the late
1890s. The Gilded Age, but no, I'd love to explore other time periods as well.
You know what? Well, what other thing came to mind when I was reading your book about that time period was steampunk. Have you ever read any? I mean, it's a totally different take on, totally different slant on that time period. But
it is.
That's some of the one of the things that just randomly came to mind.
It is. That's an interesting. It's an interesting concept. Actually, I was even reading. I think steampunk isn't it futuristic, but like.
But there's elements, a lot of elements from that really that time period, like the late 1900s, when steam power and stuff was out. So
yeah, it's fascinating. I was actually even reading yesterday an article about a woman. I think they live in maybe Washington, and she and her husband live in complete Victorian fashion.
Is that right?
clothes and everything. No, I don't think
oil lamps and everything.
Mm-hmm. Wow. But that fascinated me. Of course, that is another wormhole I went down yesterday. Yeah. It's a wonder I get any writing done.
Now, what about the Elvis book? Is there a subgenre?
It's so funny because people say women's fiction, and you said like it's a little over half the earth. In terms of the reading public, it's probably more like 75% or 80%. It's amazing how much of the readership of America is women. Women really read novels.
Yes.
So women's fiction is both a genre and the biggest category of fiction. So it's kind of a strange little world. But I consider myself to write mainstream women's fiction, which the catchphrase for that is always they call them book club books. But I love book club books because that implies to me, A, that maybe people will buy it, which is always a lovely possibility. But B, that there's something in the book that can be debated. It's possible to feel two ways about something. There's enough complexity emotionally or morally or in terms of what it means that two people could read the book and come away with a different opinion about what certain things mean. So,
and there's some depth to it.
We would hope there'd be a little bit of depth in. So in Last Ride to Graceland, there's a mother and a daughter. So there's two points of view that go back and forth in the book. And that alone, I think, gives you something to talk about because their takes on things are obviously they don't match. So who do you believe? Who do you think is the more reliable narrator?
Mm-hmm.
Who's really driving the car, basically, in kind of a metaphorical way in the book? So I like things like that. I think that it's not really a subgenre because it's big.
Right.
But I feel like it's also a very important part of what's happening in American fiction.
Okay, cool. And what about your book, Eric?
Well, I will echo everything that has been said before me. I think it's very true that women's fiction is, certainly in my interpretation and the way I look at myself as a writer, is that I write commercial fiction, mainstream fiction. Women's fiction is certainly how it's categorized. What I was really excited to do with The Last Treasure is that there are really three points of view in the story, the two men and the woman. So I love to explore the male's journey, I won't say hero in this case because I have two male leads. One is the husband and the other is the ex-boyfriend. And they were both fascinating characters for me to explore and flesh out, as exciting in my mind as a writer as it was to explore the heroine, Liv. So,
but is the heroine the main protagonist?
It is certainly her story, and that is a fair point to make. But I think it's important for me as a writer to not feel like I can't still explore the male journey or the male perspective, because I think that's just as interesting to me as a woman. It's not even that I want to just read about women's stories from women's perspective. I learn as much from writing and reading about the male perspective as I do from reading about the female perspective.
Right.
So, but this was certainly the first book I've written where I think that having two male characters who I featured so prominently in terms of the narrative, that was a first for me, and I will continue to do that, I hope, because I really enjoyed it. I think it made the experience of writing it more interesting and compelling, and I certainly hope that the readers feel that as well.
Now, the two of you, and the listener can't tell who I'm pointing to, but two of you, you have other books out, too, is that correct?
Yes.
Talk a little bit about them, too.
This is my fifth book for NAL, and it's all of my books are coastal, are set on the coast. I'm originally from New England, so my first few books were set on the coast of New England, and I've lived in North Carolina now for 8 years, and have been writing books set on the Carolina coast as well. The book before this, It Comes in Waves, was about an ex-female surfer set on Folly Beach, which I love Folly Beach.
Right.
And then Last Treasure is set on the Outer Banks in Wilmington. But my stories or usually have a pretty strong romantic subplot. I really love exploring love relationships, family relationships too, certainly, but for me, it always comes back to the romance subplot, and I think that is a lot of why I tie them to the sea. The coast and the beach feel very much like the sort of the quintessential romantic setting.
That makes sense to me.
I just love to explore that. So that's what my books previously have been about and will hopefully continue to be about.
The Last Ride to Graceland is my fourth book with Gallery, and mine have been pretty different, actually. The other ones are Love in Midair, The Unexpected Waltz, and The Canterbury Sisters. Mm. And if they've got a common denominator, it's that I love a road trip. Okay. I was a travel writer. I wrote nonfiction for years. I was 54 when my first novel came out.
Right.
And so I think there's still a little bit of a travel writer in me. I mean, uh-huh. Kind of, once a travel writer, always a travel writer. Place plays a very big role in all of them. Mm-hmm. And the one just before this one, The Canterbury Sisters, is about a group of women who walk the Canterbury Trail.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of a modern-day Canterbury Tales, uh-huh. And they start in London and walk to Canterbury Cathedral. So, and I walk that, too. So it's kind of like, where do you want to go, Kim? Write a book about it. I love to go and actually physically research the place.
And so you walk the
It's
Canterbury
60
trail.
Miles.
Wow.
Yeah. It's
and what part amazing. Of England is that in?
It's southern England. You start in London, which is pretty far south, and you walk to, Canterbury's right beside Dover, so you're really on the south of England. So, and you walk to a part of England that's not very touristy, and it's not very explored. I stayed in some so-called inns that were basically people's houses that had like a room for rent, and you kind of ate with the family. So it was an adventure. It was cool.
Well, I like the idea of using the traveling or trip as a, it almost automatically creates a spine for your storyline, doesn't it?
You're
leaving someplace,
it's moving from
familiar,
one thing to another.
You're moving physically, moving
well,
your
I mean, yeah,
story
that's the
right
classic
along
metaphor for writing is the
right.
journey. I guess I maybe take it a little more literally.
Nothing
wrong with that. So I'm interested in how the three of you hooked up for this tour. Have you known each other for a while?
We have.
They've
known
each other for longer than I have, and I got to know you guys. I think we've known each other now for about a year and a half.
It must be.
But I took a class actually from Ken back in the day.
Many moons ago.
No wonder you're a good writer.
Well, I know.
That's what turned the tide, baby. Well, we all live in Charlotte, which the hilarious thing is Charlotte's not really known as like a big literary mecca. It's
right.
You know,
not yet.
But it's got a ton of writers. It's got a almost sick amount of writers.
It does.
It's
it
so
does.
Fun.
And we found each other, weirdly enough, the initial ball started rolling through kind of social media. And that,
Well,
our fourth cohort, Mary Beth Whalen, who's not with us today, kind of started the ball rolling by inviting me to another literary event because she just found me on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So writers can get together now much more easily than they used to be able to.
Right.
You can find
right.
each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And we've been friends and worked in sort of this unofficial writers group. But in this last year, we realized we would all have books releasing over the summer, which was kind of a unique thing for our group.
Right.
So we thought, what a great opportunity to do more like a collaborative effort for touring and mm-hmm. presenting and mm-hmm. taking our stories on the road. So mm-hmm. what we've done is we have organized something that we're calling Authors Out of Carolina, okay. so that we are taking our stories and not just the four that we're presenting that we launched this summer, but just our collective stories and our experiences right. as writers and our experiences as readers. And we're really looking forward to visiting lots of different book clubs and bookstores like we're here today. So that's really how that came about. And it's not something that we found a lot of other writers are necessarily doing right now, which is what we're really excited about,
right.
is this idea that it's a group effort and we're hitting the road together. And it's been really fun to get. We've gotten a lot of great feedback from other writers saying, yeah, this is a really neat idea.
It is a cool idea.
So, yeah we're
it's
really
a lot more
excited.
Fun doing it by yourself.
It sure is. This is our first day. The tour is really beginning today, and we're already having a great time.
Okay.
Yeah, it can be kind of grim to be on the road by yourself. it really is. But it's so much more fun if you've kind of got a – and we're doing a joint launch in a couple of weeks in Matthews, and we're having a party for all of our books. So you can combine your efforts, your money, your, list of people.
Your readers.
And generate more collectively than you could individually. It's something we kind of stumbled into because of the rare – fact that four friends all have books coming out the same summer, which is just kind of lucky and serendipitous. But I think a lot of writers should do it. It seems to have a lot of benefits.
I think writers need to experiment with all kinds of marketing ideas.
Now more than ever.
Because
as you well know, it's up to the writer to market their own
work. Really? I haven't heard that.
I don't need to tell you all that.
It's awful.
It's nice, though. Even, you know, we I think writing can be such a solitary profession.
Right.
And so it's nice to have, you know, have friends that are going through the same things as you are, which a lot, you know, this is it's also a very rare profession as well. So it's fun to be able to have friends to go on the road with and talk shop with and things like that. So it's really
do you
nice.
Support yourself each other in any way during the writing process?
Yeah. I mean, we're not an official writing group that like meets once a week like some writing groups do, but we definitely have swapped our work back together and bounced ideas off each other from the start. And that was really kind of how the group formed. The group formed because we were acting as support for each other as writers. This is us supporting each other as authors. We've already written and now we're out there trying to promote the work.
Right.
And so that's, I think a lot of writers support each other through the writing process. I think what makes us a little different is that we're continuing the dynamic of supporting each other through the promotional part, too. And if any of your listeners want to follow us, we're on Facebook as Authors Out of Carolina.
Authors Out of Carolina. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's before we close, I'm going to ask each one of you for your websites, but we'll note that, too, Authors Out of Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Excellent. So the event today we're calling Truth and Fiction.
Correct.
So what is the truth? What is this about? Well, or is this something that they made up here at the store and you to just kind of frame a discussion?
Well, what I think is interesting is that just in the time that we've been sitting here talking with you is, and I've been listening with an eye towards what we're about going to talk about in the panel following this idea that we've got the truth of these historical characters.
Right.
And then we are blending that with the fiction of the other characters that we have built. So, and I think, for myself personally, and you ladies tell me what you think about in your own stories, but I have explored in several books before this one the idea of what is truth, what is a true story. I've often noticed that very often at the beginning of films, for example, they will say based on a true story or inspired by true events.
Yes.
And there's just something immediately about that.
People love that.
They do.
People
it gives it a certain amount of searching for the word here, but it makes it a lot more real. But why? What about that makes it more real? In other words, we feel the need to want the truth in something, and yet historical fiction, which is, as we've talked about, is so popular because this ability to take the truth of or somebody real from history and bring them into this, you know, bring conjecture into it. What if they were this way, or what if they met this person? And so I think it's this really interesting sort of the duplicity of that, I think, is really fascinating.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to this panel for that reason. I think it kind of just goes both ways.
Also seeing kind of that, you know, our characters are likely drawn from either real people we know, even if they're fictitious, just that they're obviously a lot of traits you can't help but be in writing that you inadvertently draw things from real life, even if you think they're fiction. So that's going to be
I can tell you from my personal experience, having written a couple books that don't have anything to do with reality. The people would, you know, oh, I really liked your book. Is it based on a true story? And I said no, and you could see the disappointment in their face, even though they liked the book.
Right.
They want to hear that's based on something that actually happened.
It's probably just because they love the characters so much, they want them to be real.
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a few more minutes here. I don't want to give you a break before your presentation. I always ask people a little bit about their writing process. But I want to skip, since I'm in the editing process now, let me skip to that. Let me start with Eric. What is your editing? You've done a first draft of a book. What do you do next?
My process over the years, I've always expected it to become, I was hoping to become a more efficient writer. And what I mean by that is that I like to think that I do a lot of my editing on the front end so that I don't have to do 10 drafts to find this character or find this plot. but it hasn't happened that way at all. If anything, I feel like I am less efficient, and whatever that is, it is what it is, and I'll let that go. But I very often will have to do many drafts. I will do that first draft. I will submit it to my editor, and we will hash out some fresh ideas, and her instincts are always spot on, and I'm very grateful for that. So that is usually the process that then I will go back in and really dig into the meat of it. And frankly, I love editing, and mm-hmm. I may be alone in this. I love the editing process. That's when I feel like things appear to me. Things I have sort of these epiphanies or revelations about characters that I wouldn't have had with that first draft. That is sort of that has been my process. And I also have, I'm very fortunate to have an agent who has just a wonderful editorial eye, and uh-huh. She just has, her ideas are always incredibly spot on. So I really benefit from a lot of very talented editorial insight around me.
And how
I'm grateful for
I don't know how to quantify this. It's probably not a fair question, but how much of your book changes? In the editing.
It can depend. It depends on the book. I think for the Last Treasure, there were not as many huge revelations in the first book I did, Little Gail Gumbo. Mm-hmm. The book changed hugely, and I won't even go into detail other than to say there was magical realism in the first draft. There was a ghost. I mean, mm-hmm. huge elements just went away, and I look back and think, thank goodness they went away. But so that was my process for that book. It really, I think, depends on the book and it depends on the story for me. How about for you?
Well, there is some truth that every book kind of has its own writing process and its own editorial process. I think that's why writers don't pick up the speed they wish they would. But the most important thing for me is after I finish a first draft is I need to put it down and walk away from it for a while. I cannot begin to edit. I try to take a month away from it if I've got a month. Because it's really hard for me. When I feel like when you're doing the first draft, you're kind of almost in the trance of the story.
Right.
And it's really hard to know what's working, what's not working. It's hard to read it, just like a normal person reads a book.
Right.
And so I like to really take a break and then go through and tweak it a little bit myself. One of the things that's really changed in my editorial process is I used to solicit a lot more feedback than I now do. I think one of the beauties of getting farther into your career is that you end up with just three or four really key readers that you know you can go to. Mm-hmm. I used to, editing by committee. I mean, just like, what do you think? And I think sometimes when you're writing group that happens, there might be eight people and you get maybe almost too much feedback. I've gotten very selective about my feedback, and that's probably the two biggest things that have changed with me mm-hmm. From the first book to editing this is that I give myself a longer gap before I go back, and mm-hmm. I'm really strategic about who I ask for feedback.
Okay. And what about you?
Well, let's see. I generally, like Erica, my changes with each manuscript I write. But I think with Fifth Avenue in particular, it was really nice. I think I sent it in. I probably did about four different drafts. But, mm-hmm. of course, it just depends on... They, of course, all weren't just complete overhauls. I think you have generally one... big overhaul of your book, and sometimes that can just mean deepening the characters, which is what I did with Fifth Avenue a lot, which is really digging into the characters and the sisters in particular and making sure that each one was as distinct as I'd imagined, and so that was a really nice activity to do. And then my next book, which I just turned in my big overhaul edits for, was fun. I got to actually add some things. So it just depends, mm-hmm. I think, in each manuscript, each book. Like these girls were saying, just every process is different. I think you kind of... I used to, for instance, even my plotting, I used to plot out a lot more meticulously.
Right.
And now I kind of just do a rough thing and say, hey, something's going to surprise me. Let's just go with it.
so you're when you're outlining or... plotting out, you're just putting down some points to hit on the way, is that?
Yeah, basically, I'd like to do kind of a chapter outline now, but it's not very intense. It's just things I'd like to see, and then they always change. So.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens to your word count in editing? Does it go up or go down?
My word count, it depends. I mean, it doesn't seem to usually go. I don't have a lot of words to cut. That's never the issue on my end. it always seems to be kind of even. That's an interesting question. I've never thought about that because it's never very dramatic for me. What about you?
It isn't for me either. It's really weird. I think that is one thing that you kind of get better at through experience, is knowing what 100,000 words or 90,000 or whatever you're trying to hit feels like.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people have what I call like first book itis. I mean, I certainly had it with my first book, where they just end up too long. That's one of the typical things that happens. And, you know, you end up with 150 or 200,000, God help you, words.
Right.
And but I think as you get better, it's kind of like, you know, your sense of how long 20 minutes is. You just get where you have some sense of this is how long it takes to tell the story.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you know what happened to your word count, Joy?
Yes. I mean, mine, I consider myself a long-winded writer, but really it doesn't, I guess I'm not that long-winded because it doesn't change that much. Luckily, I think when I'm writing, since it's a historical, I feel like I am adding in a lot of descriptors to establish a sense of place, but I think, I guess I'm not doing it in this long-winded paragraphs of describing someone's, you know, eye color or shoes. I think I like to do it in little, you know, in the action, so it tends to be pretty much the same, like these girls.
I talked to a lot of people that it seems like it's more often that they're cutting things out. It goes lower. I talked to one guy that wrote a pretty popular book, actually. He started out, I started talking about the editing. He said, well, it started out as 180,000 words.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
I just walked out.
I don't even know how you'd find the book in 180,000
words. I don't know how. I wouldn't know what to cut. I think I'd have to have
That seems like tour.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Anyway, listen, I need to let you ladies get a little break before
well,
you're... Thank you very much.
Thank
so
you.
I want to ask you one by one, mm-hmm. how do your fans follow you?
Okay, well, I have...
say your name.
Oh, this is Joy Calloway, and on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at JoyWCal, C-A-L. And then my website is just joycalloway.com, and that's actually spelled like the golf company. So it's C-A-L-L-A-W-A-Y.
Okay.
And Facebook, obviously look us up at Authors Out of Carolina.
Okay, and Kim?
Yes, I can be followed on Twitter at Kim-Wright-W. And also Authors Out of Carolina, and my site is kimwright.org.
Okay.
And my website is ericamarksauthor.com. I am on Twitter at ericamarksauthor, but without the O. Sorry to be so tricky. Instagram, ericamarkswriter. That's my Instagram. And on Facebook as well, ericamarksauthor. Or just go to our Authors Out of Carolina Facebook, and you can reach us there too. We would love to connect with any individual readers or writers, but we also...
Or book clubs.
I was going to say, we love to visit book clubs. A lot of book clubs do not realize that authors want so much to connect with you in person or on Skype or a phone or whatever.
Yeah,
so,
book clubs are really fun.
They are so much fun.
I love it.
They really are. Well, thank you, ladies, so much.
Thank you so much. Best of luck to you with all your
promotions and books, and best luck in the future.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to Joy Calloway, Erica Marks, and Kim Wright. Thanks to the Novels and Novelty Bookstore, and thank you for listening. For other episodes or to subscribe, you can visit us at themiddleoftheair.com. Thank you.